Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How powerful are global hacker collectives, and what exactly are they trying to prove? With attacks against national governments, media organizations, credit card companies, and the Church of Scientology, the group Anonymous, along with its spin-off LulzSec, have succeeded in creating major disruptions for the organizations they target. But are they vigilantes with a serious agenda, or simply vandals looking to stir up trouble for its own sake? And do we need to be worried about what hackers will do next? Parmi Olson is London Bureau Chief for Forbes magazine, and she's been reporting on this underworld for some time. She's also had direct contact with many of the major players. Her new book is called We Are Anonymous, Inside the Hacker World of LulzSec, Anonymous, and the Global Cyber Insurgency. Parmi, welcome to Think.
Hi, thank you.
I think some people sort of file these stories away and say, well, they matter to the tech savvy. But I wonder if you would start by talking about why it's important for all of us to understand the power of these global hacker groups.
Sure. A really important part of all this is that most of the people in Anonymous aren't really hackers. They're just a new generation of people who have grown up with the Internet. So they understand the Internet really well, and they understand that culture really well. So what this kind of shows us is, for one thing, how vulnerable our information is online. So many of us now almost live our lives online. We interact with each other online through social networks, Facebook and Twitter, LinkedIn. And there's just thousands of pieces of information about us out there. And the people who are able to, who really understand the Internet, the highways and byways of this kind of new landscape where people are setting up businesses and communicating with each other, which we have yet to fully understand, they're the ones who almost have, you know, they're able to stay oftentimes a step ahead of the authorities. They have a kind of control almost of parts of that landscape. And so I think what Anonymous kind of shows us is just these new ways of subverting the Internet. It's that what they do is actually much easier than you'd be surprised how easy it is to actually hack a website these days. And it affects anyone who really has a kind of online presence, because we all do.
And they're different from some other groups, Anonymous and LulzSec, in that they're not doing this to seek financial gain, but that does not mean they have not caused significant financial losses.
Right, right, exactly. I mean, and it's difficult to put a number on exactly how much damage that they've caused. You know, there have been numbers thrown out there, like hundreds of millions of dollars worth of damage. Sony, for instance, has used has made those kinds of statements, and the same with an IT security contractor called H.P. Gary, which was the target of a very dramatic attack by Anonymous last year. But you're right. I mean, the intention for the most part isn't to make money. It really is to cause a stir. And as you were mentioning earlier in your introduction, you know, are these guys doing it because they want to make a political point or because they want to do it for fun? It's actually a bit of both. It's a very, is quite a dichotomy, actually, between people, supporters of Anonymous, who just want to disrupt the Internet and other people's online profiles and data for fun, for kicks, to entertain everyone else, and those who actually increasingly want to make a kind of socio-political point. That's actually the kind of direction that Anonymous is heading in at the moment, is this more serious direction.
It is and has been a challenge, though, to sort of unify a group of people who at present are mostly similar and brought together by their disdain for authority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and but again, this is a really good illustration of how organizations and things are being organized more and more today in this increasingly digitally open society. You have the growth of tactics like crowdsourcing, a lot of you know, communities, online communities like Reddit. These are all growing online communities where there are no leaders, no hierarchy, no structure, no rules, and yet the people within them are able to collaborate, and they're able to organize things, and they're able to move forward with various activities. And I think that's, you know, that's why Anonymous, actually, when I was investigating it and writing the book, I found it was so messy, actually, that the way that they work. And there's a lot of, you know, chaos and no real planning or long-term planning for the most part. And yet they're able to be so effective in getting media attention, in hacking a website. And I think that just goes to show kind of how the change in how we're organizing ourselves and collaborating online today.
What has, obviously you understand this subject matter quite well, but I'm curious as to your perspective about what the coverage of groups like Anonymous and LulzSec have demonstrated about the lack of knowledge by many members of the media in covering these attacks.
Sure. I mean, when I first started writing about it, one of the reasons I wanted to write about it was I noticed that a lot of the reports about Anonymous were kind of rehashes of other reports, and there weren't that many outlets actually trying to interview the people in Anonymous and just find out who those people really were and how they were actually organizing themselves. And what I kind of found was that the perception of Anonymous, particularly from the media, actually this is less now, but especially a year ago, was that Anonymous was this very big calculating organization, that it was a group of super hackers. You know, terms like that have actually been used. And Anonymous, like the people in Anonymous actually totally live that up. They're very happy for that perception to be propagated because it gives them greater influence. It gives them a sense of power and kind of amplifies that sense of significance and authority when actually they're mostly small groups of people working together. The kind of beauty of Anonymous actually is that it's this collective identity that anybody can wrap themselves into. And it amplifies their voice because there's a reputation behind it, and so many people have been able to share that reputation. I think the media is coming to understand that more and more. So nowadays, instead of referring to Anonymous as a group of hackers, more people are referring to them as a movement or a collective or a nebulous collective of kind of subversive internet users, not necessarily hackers.
So let's talk about the evolution of Anonymous as an organization, if indeed that is at least the closest word to describe it. What is 4chan, and what role did that site play in bringing together the people that formed Anonymous?
I mean, 4chan was very important. It was kind of the root of Anonymous, the home of Anonymous. It was started in 2003 by a young man named Christopher Poole, who was really into Japanese anime, and he was looking at these discussion boards from Japan. One was called 2chan, and it was basically this very rapidly moving discussion board where people who could just post about anything they wanted. And he created the same thing. He pretty much just almost cloned the site and called it 4chan. And about a year after he had created it, he implemented this forced anonymity so that the users of the site couldn't have nicknames. They were forced to be anonymous with every post. And people really didn't like that at first, but eventually they kind of took to it, and they started to realize that actually there was some benefit to that. For one, there was kind of a lack of ego, and people could be much more free in what they said. There was a sense of spontaneity to the discussions. And over the course of years, people were actually quite creative in the things that they were coming up with in their discussions. They came up with what's known as internet memes and image macros, so these kinds of well-known images or comics that you see getting spread around Facebook now and Twitter. A lot of these originally came from 4chan. And another thing that developed over the years was this ability to mass together, kind of flash mob, other rival sites that they didn't like. So they would spam another rival image board or the website of some disc jockey that they didn't like. And then in 2008, it was, you know, as that power was growing, a few people realized they could harness that collective power. And they, I don't know if you remember the video of Tom Cruise talking about Scientology.
Right.
When that came out and Scientology tried to stop that video from going on YouTube, people on 4chan decided, okay, well, let's retaliate. And so they decided to spam the website of Scientology. Now, a lot of them thought, this is just for fun. We're just doing this as a joke. But kind of what ended up happening is that it took a much more kind of serious direction. People started learning and researching Scientology and deciding that they didn't like it and turning it into an actual kind of focused protest that went on for several months.
And there were physical iterations of those protests as well.
That's right. And that's something that hasn't really happened so much since then. This was almost like a kind of blip in the Anonymous history where some of the organizers thought, well, this is just going to be really funny if we take the internet outside and actually physically stand in front of the Scientology churches and hold up banners. And, you know, a lot of these, when they did protest, they were out there wearing the masks. and they were holding signs. It wasn't your typical protest at all with anything serious written on the signs. Sometimes there was, but a lot of times it was just some kind of joke about lolcats or, you know, just it was very just meant to be irreverent and didn't make sense to a lot of people who were walking past. But to people in Anonymous, it was all part of this one very, very big inside joke, and it was just one big prank. But it did just over time become more serious.
What's the significance of the Guy Fawkes masks in particular?
You know, I haven't really been able to pinpoint where that started or how that started. It's, again, just one of those things that kind of gained, like, the, you know, this viral quality of the Internet. It just became popular, and people latched on to the imagery of the Guy Fawkes mask. And I guess it comes from that moment in the movie V for Vendetta where this whole crowd of people put on this mask in solidarity with the main Guy Fawkes character, just to show that they are part of this collective. And in a sense, there's this diffusion of responsibility and a diffusion of accountability, but in along with that comes this kind of profound power and amplification of a voice or an agenda.
So we'll talk about the conflict between people who are mostly involved for the sake of sort of pulling pranks and the people who are largely involved because they feel like this is a potentially powerful social tool. But talk, if you would, about the creation of some of these players of kind of alternate alter egos online.
Yeah, and this is something that we've seen online already for many years. When you go online, because it's just text and on a screen, it's not a picture of you or it's not you yourself, you can kind of live out an alter ego. You can be anybody that you want to be. You can be another gender, you can be another age, you can have a completely different personality online. And on certain chat networks, people can actually develop a whole different persona. And oftentimes those in the Anonymous community, those personas are kind of interacting with each other. What Anonymous does is it kind of, because there's this sense of vigilantism and purpose, it kind of amplifies that with a kind of moral high ground. But within Anonymous, when I was talking to the people who were the supporters, the people within the community, there were many different types of characters. And for instance, one of the very key interviewees for the book, their name was Kayla, and they were claiming to be a 16-year-old girl, and they had this very elaborate backstory about growing up in the countryside, never wanting to say which country, of course, but, you know, just completely dedicated to that persona and that characterization of themselves.
And we won't give away the secret, but that we'll just say that was entirely a fabrication.
Well, yeah, the police ended up arresting someone who they claim was using that name. And at this point, that person, Ryan Aykroyd, who's a 26-year-old male from Northern England and was in the Army for 5 years, has pleaded not guilty to all of the four charges that have been leveled against him. So there's going to be a trial next April 2013, and at this point, it's really just a matter of letting the course of justice play out and see what details come up in that trial. But I would say that the very idea of doing that, of putting a kind of false persona online, is very common in Anonymous. Not everybody does that, but one reason to do that is, one, it's just an enjoyable thing to do. If you have an alter ego, you can live it out, and why not? And two, it's actually a protective measure. You know, people in Anonymous oftentimes are doing things which can be illegal. And so to kind of protect yourself from the eyes of the law, you want to obfuscate your identity as much as possible. And also that's just part of the ethos of Anonymous, is not having your real name and not projecting that.
Parmi Olson is with us. She's London Bureau Chief for Forbes magazine and author of the new book, We Are Anonymous, Inside the Hacker World of LulzSec, Anonymous, and the Global Cyber Insurgency. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Parmi Olsen. She's London Bureau Chief for Forbes magazine and author of We Are Anonymous, Inside the Hacker World of LulzSec, Anonymous, and the Global Cyber Insurgency. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Parmi, I'm going to make some gross generalizations here, but I will say there are people who think this is fantastic. There is power to be had. We can make a statement and tell the world what we believe, and this should be the purpose of Anonymous and of hacktivism. And there are other people who say that ruins everything. We really just want to have a good time.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, there continues to be a real conflict between the two sides of that story. And the guys who think that Anonymous should just be all about having fun and messing with people and harassing people for kicks. Those are actually the guys who've been with it for the longest. That's kind of where Anonymous originally came from, was from image boards where people would collaborate on doing that kind of thing. So there really is, you know, there's a sharing of tips and tricks how to manipulate the Internet, how to manipulate people, and, you know, how people use those. That sharing of information really varies quite a bit.
As you mentioned earlier, some of these things are easier to achieve than people realized. For a while, people assumed that the way that Anonymous was able to launch these very large attacks had to do with having an untold number of volunteers sort of helping out. Not necessarily the case.
Right. One of the things that I found out just from trying to get to the bottom of how the attacks on PayPal.com, MasterCard, and Visa.com took place in December 2010 when Anonymous was avenging WikiLeaks after those companies nixed funding to WikiLeaks. I found out that actually at the time what was being reported was that thousands of volunteers were coming onto the Anonymous chat networks and they'd all downloaded this software tool that allowed them to become part of this voluntary network, like a kind of like thousands of guns all being pointed at a particular website, and that's how they took it down. That's only part of the story. In fact, when those people were part of that network, they did kind of point the tools at the website, but that just it wasn't enough firepower in the end. And in the background, in one of these private chat rooms where on the Anonymous chat network, the operators of that network were also in collaboration with two guys who were in control of botnets. Botnets are a network of infected computers, known as zombie computers, that when you strike in a command on your IRC channel, you can get all those computers to go to a website at the same time and spam it with junk traffic, and that's pretty much what they did. So when we had maybe about 5,000 people using that small software tool, on the other hand, thinking that they were taking down the website, very quietly in the background, there was a guy wielding a botnet with something like 70,000 zombie computers, much more powerful, much more effective, that actually took down the website. What's kind of ironic is that some people ended up getting arrested in the United States for taking part in those attacks, for using the small software tool, and actually using that tool hadn't even been all that effective. But, you know, whatever the case, it was something that Anonymous didn't want to really reveal too much because it kind of devalues that sense of power of the horde and the hive mind. And also they didn't want to bring too much attention to those guys who had the botnet. But since then, anyway, we just haven't seen those kinds of numbers coming together on an Anonymous chat network anyway. And really the way that Anonymous works effectively is in small groups, not with thousands of people pooling together. Again, that was like the physical demonstrations against Scientology. This was a one-off when thousands of people got together. It tends to be groups of dozens, maybe less.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Shane in Dallas. Hello, Shane.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question for Parmi was, are the numbers of Anonymous growing? Like, are they like actively like taking in new people? And if so, like, do you know anything about like how that works out?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's actually very hard to quantify Anonymous. Like I was saying, in December 2010, there was up to around 7,800, I think was the highest point, number of people on the main Anonymous chat network. So that gives you a sense of how many people at that point were really keenly, actively kind of discussing with anonymous organizers. And, you know, it's like a crowd of people that is just constantly shifting. People are coming and going. Some people are in it for years. Some people are in it for 1 or 2 days. And so it's hard to say how many people are in it. I would, or are supporting it. I would say at a guess we're talking thousands, tens of thousands of people around the world who consider themselves supporters of Anonymous. And then you're going to have a core of maybe a few hundred very impassioned organizers. But again, that number is just constantly in flux.
How much, Parmi, do they know about one another, the most active members?
You know, I don't think they know very much about each other because, you know, there have been some recent moments of upheaval for Anonymous where certain very core figureheads were arrested. One of them, I'm sure we'll get to this soon enough, was Hector Monsegur, known as Babu, the charismatic almost leader at that point. And he was arrested, and it turned out he was actually an FBI informant. Since then, a lot of the organizers in Anonymous have really gone much more deeply underground than before. They're much more careful about the information they reveal to each other about themselves, compartmentalizing information much more. So really, they don't know that much about each other. They perhaps did know more in the past, and now they're just being very, very careful about what they reveal. So it's bad. It's actually bad etiquette in Anonymous when you're chatting with someone to ask, oh, so, you know, where are you from? What do you do outside of, what do you do in the real world or in real life, or IRL as they abbreviate it? And it's just bad form to ask those kinds of questions.
And people are even careful to avoid using, I guess most of this is conducted in English, but avoid using forms of English that would mark one's geographic origins.
Yeah, and there are certain tricks that you can use to circumvent that. So, you know, if you're in America, you might want to spell certain words in the UK style, so color with a U, that sort of thing. And it's all about trying to obfuscate your true location and true identity. So that can even involve fabricating certain things. And, you know, when Anonymous, people with Anonymous do that to each other, they don't take offense because they know that it has to be done. And so it's almost like this habitual lying or habitual kind of manipulation of a person's true identity, but it's never done, or oftentimes it's not done in a malevolent kind of way. It's just, well, that's kind of the par with the course. You have to do that to protect yourself.
So the attacks that have been successful and widely reported, there have been reasons given for them after the fact. But in some ways, they seem to those of us observing from outside to be rather, if not capricious, certainly random. In other words, someone gets offended by something and then there is this major attack that may or may not be proportionate to the offense in the first place.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what you learned about how they sort of choose their targets?
It's actually, like you were saying, opportunistic. So when LulzSec came about, I was talking with the guys in the group as they were forming and as the attacks were happening and finding out why they were choosing those targets. And actually, oftentimes, the case was that they were scanning the web for vulnerabilities in the websites of high-profile targets like Fox.com, like PBS, like InfraGuard, which is an affiliate of the FBI. So it wasn't so much, okay, let's brainstorm about who we're going to go after next. Okay, we don't like PBS. Let's go for PBS. It wasn't like that at all. It was actually everybody goes off and looks for the vulnerabilities. And then they'll put a list together of the websites that have vulnerabilities. And then once they see a target which they think, oh, this is a good one to go after, then one of them will go in and try and exploit that vulnerability, see if there's a way to actually get into the web application, into the site, and steal some data. And so it really, and then when they announce it, what was happening in LulzSec at least, they would announce it as if it had all been planned, and this was the reason why they actually went after this particular target. So it gave the illusion that it was all planned, when actually it wasn't quite like that.
You had pretty extensive access to a young man known online as Topiary, in the IRL as Jake Davis. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, Topiary was very well known within the community of Anonymous when he was active within it and when he was organizing things. He started off actually years ago as doing prank calls on a website called Tiny Chat, and he would do the calls on Skype, and then hundreds of people could listen in on the calls, and it was just they kind of roaring with laughter, and they found it very entertaining. And more recently, he kind of stumbled upon Anonymous and kind of took a more serious turn in his own activities and was helping to write these official, well, you can't really call them official, but press releases and statements from Anonymous whenever they would attack a website. And so he was kind of seen as a very good communicator within the community. And the operators in the main network, the people who were maintaining the chat infrastructure, could have noticed him quite early on and were inviting him into some of these very exclusive private chat rooms, for instance, where the guys with the botnets were hanging out. And he got to really see almost every corner of how the community was working and how these things were being organized. It ended up being a very useful source for me to find out how the network worked. And as he got to know more people, he also met Sabu, and then he met Kayla, and they established very strong kind of friendships. And they worked together very well as a team. Topiary was this communicator, very good at writing press releases and very funny. And Sabu was this router, like this hacker who was very good at finding ways to exploit a vulnerability in a site, and Kayla was the same. And when the three of them worked together, they could become this very powerful entity.
Do the members have ways of sort of testing whether or not they can trust the other people they're communicating with?
That's a good question. I don't think there's any hard and fast way, and oftentimes people just have to use their gut instincts, and they just have to be careful about who they decide to trust and who they don't trust. You know, with Topiary, he really, truly trusted Sabu, and he really, truly trusted Kayla and some of the other people that ended up becoming part of their group, Lulzsec. And, eventually, Topiary, Jake Davis, became suspicious of Sabu, and lots of people were becoming suspicious of Sabu, whether he was an informant or not. But, it's interesting. When it was revealed that he was an FBI informant, I was speaking to some other hackers in Anonymous, like, well, how do you feel now that you know? Why didn't you say something before? And a lot of guys were just like, well, you know, it was very hard to confront him about it. He kind of played down any kind of suspicions that we had. So if someone is charming and charismatic enough, they can, in spite of any kind of logical rationale that would suggest that they're not to be trusted, they can foster a lot of trust. It was pretty extraordinary how Sabu managed to do that.
What kinds of penalties are there for those who are found to be guilty that would encourage someone like Sabu to inform for the FBI to lessen his own sentence?
Well, when when Hector Monsegur was arrested on June 6, 2011, the understanding is that the police threatened him with possible incarceration of 2 years. They had evidence to show that he'd been taking part in some kind of credit card scam or online selling of credit card numbers, and so they used that as a kind of tool to force his hand and get him to agree to cooperate. He had two young daughters or two young girls that he was guardian over, and they kind of got used that against him to cooperate. You know, people have since been arrested, and there are court cases being played out at the moment, but no one has really been sentenced yet. So we know that taking part in a DDoS attack, for instance, in the United States and in the United Kingdom carries a sentence of up to 10 years.
Let me interrupt you. Distributed denial of service attacks.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So what we were talking about before were, you know, these thousands of people take part in an attack against a website to take it down. That's, you know, a simplistic way of saying that's basically a DDoS attack. If you take part in that, even if you were just downloading one of those small software tools, it's an incredibly punitive measure. It's a possible sentence of 10 years. Now, no one's actually been sentenced yet. As far as I know, no one's actually been convicted. So it's still kind of early days to know really how the authorities are and how the court systems are going to play this out. But as far as we know, it's actually very, very heavy punishments if you get involved in this kind of thing.
Certainly it's challenging because so many of the offenders in these cases are operate out of every corner of the globe, and there are different jurisdictions to deal with. How is law enforcement trying to coordinate its efforts to stop people from causing these attacks?
I think it's, to be honest, they seem to be doing a fairly good job in one way. They managed to get most of the people in LulzSec and arrest them and round them up, and they got some people who were attacking PayPal as well. You know, PayPal actually managed to track where they say that they had 1,000 IP addresses that were involved in the worst IP addresses that were involved in the attack against it, which is basically 1,000 different computers, and the police eventually arrested about 14 people, and those people are on trial. So, you know, they are managing to track people down. On the other hand, stopping Anonymous itself is, you know, it's almost impossible because, again, this is a leaderless organization, if you want to call it an organization. It's a leaderless movement. And when we think about who's doing the tracking here, the authorities, the FBI, IT security companies, you know, these are institutions that have very clear kind of hierarchies and structures themselves and rules. And so it's very hard for them to wrap their heads around how something like Anonymous actually works when it's not formed in the same way. I think that's something that they're kind of learning along the way. And I wonder, I haven't managed to find out the full details on what it was like for the FBI to use Sabu as an informant. My guess is that it was an incredibly stressful time for them to see through his eyes the world that he was inhabiting at that time for the many months that he was an informant, how rapidly paced it was, how frenetic it was, how all over the place people's ideas were, and just keeping track of that, you know, as a kind of bureaucratic authority or institution, and figuring out where to go next in terms of their investigation.
Parmi Olson is with us. She's London Bureau Chief for Forbes magazine, and she's author of the new book, We Are Anonymous, Inside the Hacker World of LulzSec, Anonymous, and the Global Cyber Insurgency. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. If you'd like to add something or ask a question, join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Forbes magazine's London Bureau Chief, Parmi Olson. Her new book is called We Are Anonymous, Inside the Hacker World of LulzSec, Anonymous, and the Global Cyber Insurgency. You can send email to Think to join the conversation, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Parmi, I realize you are a journalist and not a psychotherapist, but I wonder if you can speak a little bit to, and you write about this, there were certain members of these organizations that seem to have been looking for not only making these statements, but it was personal in a sense of sort of looking for identity and a place in the world.
Yeah, I think so. One of the things that Anonymous offered a lot of people and continues to offer a lot of people is a community. And I think that's something that we all want and feel that we need. People who tend to struggle to socialize in the real world can sometimes find it easier to do that in these online communities, and so it becomes almost even more important to them as a community. What I found with the people who were particularly organizing things with Anonymous, some of the guys in LulzSec, was that in the real world they were perhaps drifting a little bit, they were perhaps unemployed, and when Anonymous comes along, there it is. It's that kind of purpose that you've been looking for so long or didn't realize that you needed, and there it is, and they really latched onto it. I think that was really the case with Sabu. He was also unemployed at the time that he first really got involved with Anonymous in late 2010, and when I talked to him about it, he said that, you know, he's always been kind of interested in you know, kind of activist movements and activism itself. And he said that Anonymous was the movement he'd been waiting his whole life for. He was really just so excited to be part of it and to feel as though he was changing the world in some way. And a lot of the guys who are part of it kind of have that same kind of sentiment, that they, not only are they a, there is this incredible sense of camaraderie when they work together, and if they pull off an operation or a hack or a raid, an incredible sense of euphoria that follows that. And they can live off that for days and days, and then it's all about planning the next heist and how to make it even bigger and better. And when there's this, when that's kind of coupled with this sense of vigilantism, it really does drive people. And you can imagine, if you're quite isolated in real life, then you're absolutely going to be coming back to that again and again.
Mm-hmm. Clearly, there was risk-taking involved. To what extent do you think just plain old hubris was part of Lulzsec's undoing?
I beg your pardon? Oh, plain old hubris, yes.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think with anything, that's not going to help matters. And a lot of the guys who were in Lulzsec, each one of them had their own Twitter feed. So, for instance, someone like Kayla didn't really start going on Twitter until Lulzsec came around. So it was kind of ironic that within Anonymous, a really important ethos of being part of it, part of the phenomenon, was not to have an ego and not to use it as a platform to promote your own celebrity. And perhaps that's not what Lulzsec was initially trying to do, but when they got caught up in the limelight and there was, you know, the main guy behind the Lulzsec Twitter feed would tweet something, and the next thing you knew, someone was writing about it in a tech blog or on a kind of big media outlet, getting lots of headlines, it did kind of go to their head a little bit. And so, you know, it was, I think, we don't know exactly how the police tracked each one of them down or all of them down, but I wouldn't be surprised if the fact that they were online so much, you know, it's very difficult to drop a nickname. You know, these guys are, again, meant to be anonymous, but they'll use a nickname for months on end, and once that nickname has credibility and cachet and it kind of almost has a following, it's actually very difficult to drop that and go back to being anonymous. And in the end, if the police catch you and they can connect you to that nickname, they've got a whole bunch of things that they can connect you to as well. So it does become a big struggle over ego.
Email from Steve asks whether there might be a movie in the works based on this book.
Yeah, we have had some interest coming from filmmakers. So I know that that's something that an agent who represents me is dealing with at the moment. So we'll just have to see. I think I really am curious how anyone would manage to translate something like this onto the screen, because so much of the action and the dialogue takes place in chat rooms. And, you know, perhaps if it was done in a very stylized kind of way, that might work in the way that people imagine this world in their heads. But we'll see.
Are you willing to share a little bit of what your process was for sort of tracking these folks down and knowing that you had the person you thought you had on the other end of the screen?
You know, one of the reasons why I tried not to talk to too many people, that's one of the reasons why I tried not to talk to dozens and dozens of people. Of course, I did talk to lots of people, but as far as focusing the book, I wanted to focus the book on just a few people rather than trying to get to know a lot of people a little bit, get to know a few people a lot. And that's why I would try to talk to people. If I could eventually gain their trust, I could talk to them on the phone, and some of them I could meet face-to-face. So, of course, there was always that possibility that you're not necessarily talking to the person you think you're talking to, but, you know, on these IRC networks, if you have a nickname, you register that nickname so that if someone comes on trying to be you, that person ends up getting found out. Some of these people I was talking to on other kind of cat clients where it wouldn't have really been possible to fake that name. So for the most part, I was pretty confident about, you know, the people I was talking to being definitely those people. Of course, in the beginning especially, I wasn't so familiar with the culture in Anonymous and the culture of trolling and manipulation, and it took me a while to kind of recognize when people were being manipulative and weren't necessarily telling me the truth. But when I approach people in Anonymous, you know, my reporting has never been sensationalist. I've never tried to kind of overhype the story, but really just lay the facts bare. And I think when I was talking to people in the community, they appreciated that, and it made them more willing to just talk to me pretty genuinely and sincerely.
Did you have no moments of worry that somebody would just hack your Twitter account or your email or your Facebook?
Yeah, I think it would have been silly if I wasn't worried about that. And so I've, you know, to this day, I continue to rotate my passwords on all my web accounts, and I have different passwords for everyone, and they're pretty long, pretty strong passwords. And really, everyone should do that. It's just a rule of thumb, really. But as yet, nothing's really happened. I have had a few moments where my computer just kind of froze up or stopped working, and I wondered if something had happened. But as yet, nothing like that's happened to me.
Yeah, it's funny. Most of us have that happen all the time, and we don't worry that there's a global collective of hackers after us.
Right.
Talk about how groups like Anonymous, like LulzSec, and like the others that exist elsewhere in the world for different purposes, perhaps, have changed the nature of corporate internet security.
Well, you know, there was a survey done a few months ago among IT security professionals and IT administrators in various corporations, and a strong majority of them actually were worried about Anonymous. This was perceived as, I think it was the number one threat. I don't think that necessarily has to be the case. I think what Anonymous has shown is just how easy it is to steal from a website, to attack a website database, and actually how vulnerable a lot of these websites are. You know, a lot of companies really just need to invest a little bit more in their cybersecurity and update the different tools that they're using to protect themselves. Often it's just a matter of a quick check. And, you know, the kind of silver lining to Anonymous is at least if they do attack you, they're going to announce it and they're going to publicize it. Whereas if it's a real hardened cyber criminal, and they are out there, if anything, they're bigger, more kind of a serious threat, they're going to be very quiet about the way they attack, and they're going to slip away quietly. So at least with Anonymous, you know that something's actually happened to you.
Did you get the sense from any of your interviews that a group like Anonymous could eventually take on attacks that could have impact on the physical world?
You know, that's something that people have been talking about. I haven't seen anything related to that of a serious nature. There's been talk of, well, what if they attack infrastructure? And I know some various figures of authority have cited that as a possible scenario. But, you know, to be honest, what I've heard from people within Anonymous themselves is really I haven't heard anything of that nature being planned. Mm-hmm. So that would be beyond what I've heard.
Is there a culture by which they sort of police one another?
Not really, no. I mean, police, it depends on how you define that. You'll sometimes have in a chat room people discussing a raid or a particular issue that's come up about internet regulation or something that people strongly disagree with, and you'll have someone come in and start talking about something that Anonymous is doing that they really disagree with, and there'll just be a discussion about it. It's never there's no way that you can police it. The most you can do is if you're an actual chat network operator and you have a certain status within the rooms, you can actually ban people from coming into those rooms, or you can stop them from talking. So that's kind of perhaps the one measure of policing that goes on, but oftentimes that can turn into quite a bit of e-drama and squabbling, and there's a lot of politics involved in that. But it's never so much about the true, searching for the true ethos of Anonymous. Those kinds of squabbles tend to just be quite personal and petty.
Do the members of Anonymous worry at all about other groups sort of coming in and claiming to be Anonymous?
I think that's just a byproduct of what happens when you have an organization or a collective like that with this collective identity. Anyone can use it. Actually, that's kind of what happened last year when hackers broke into the websites of the network of Sony PlayStation, mm-hmm. and compromised the PlayStation network and compromised the financial and personal details of tens of millions of users, and then when Sony did their own investigation, they revealed that there had been a file planted by the hackers that said Anonymous, we are Legion. And everybody I spoke to in Anonymous at the time said they had no idea what that was about. And what that looks like is, instead of it may have been the hackers trying to create the illusion that this was an Anonymous calling card when they were actually trying to throw the police scent off their tail. So yes, that does happen, and that is an issue for Anonymous, but I don't think it plagues them as a particularly big problem.
Why do you think that these activists, and they're not all hackers, but people who are associated with Anonymous are by and large men?
Yeah, I mean, they're not all men. There are some women, but I think that's just the nature of the internet and technology. You know, there's a very famous internet saying called "There are no girls on the internet," mm-hmm. and if someone is claiming to be a girl, then they're not. It's a guy, or it's maybe an FBI agent. So I think that's just part and parcel of internet history. There is just kind of the situation, the circumstances that there tend to be more guys on these image boards, and the girls, when they do come on, they're kind of told to undress themselves to prove that they are girls. So it is a kind of chauvinistic kind of world in many ways. But it's becoming more accepting also, you know, the more, as Anonymous becomes more serious and more socially, with a more socio-political activist bent, I think there's kind of a more of an acceptance of women as well as men and transgender. Mm-hmm. There's lots of transgender people as well.
Parmi, did you like the people that you had a chance to interview more consistently than some of the others?
I did. I found them to be extraordinarily talented people. Eloquent people, Sabu, Kayla, Topiary, they were all just very highly intelligent individuals. They were funny, they were passionate and committed to what they were doing, even though it kind of seemed like a perhaps unwise trail to go down. And that's one of the things that kind of kept me going. I was just intrigued to find out what they were going to do next and what was going to happen next. They really are quite compelling personalities, each one of them.
You mentioned earlier that, you know, just as a personal user, you change your passwords often and you don't use the same one twice. Can you offer some other ideas for people who just want to make sure that whatever they do online is their own business?
Yeah, I think, you know, if someone approaches you on Facebook and just out of the blue, this is one of the guys who I interviewed considers himself to be part of the core of Anonymous, so he's with 4chan. And what he does is he goes on Facebook, he finds somebody that he wants to harass, usually because someone on 4chan has requested that this person become a target, and so he'll go after that person on Facebook and send them a direct message. And if it's a girl, he'll be another girl, or he'll usually play the part of a girl, actually. He has something like 20 different fake Facebook profiles that he can sign into at any one time, and just start asking that person questions. And then he'll ask him, you know, just kind of small talk. And then one of the questions might be, you know, do you ever have any pets? What's the name of your, was the name of your first pet? And then right there you have the answer to that person's security question to get their password for Facebook or for Hotmail or whatever else. So there's that goes on. That tactic is called social engineering.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. It sounds like you have a great list of things for us, but people will read the book and get some interesting information as well.
All right.
Parmi Olson's book is called We Are Anonymous, Inside the Hacker World of Lulzsec, Anonymous, and the Global Cyber Insurgency. Parmi, thank you so much for giving us this hour.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about Think and download the free daily podcast online at kera.org/think. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, those can go to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.